From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a medical vagabond who has performed surgery in war zones, in South African townships, on a ship, and in hospitals. We talk with Dr. Jonathan Kaplan. He grew up in South Africa, where his first casualties were students demonstrating against apartheid. Kaplan has written a new memoir called The Dressing Station. Also, Michael Kinsley tells us some of the things he's learned about web publishing in the past 6 years. He's the founding editor of Slate, an online magazine of politics and culture. This month, he announced he's stepping down from that position. In December, he disclosed he had Parkinson's disease. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush spoke a few minutes ago with U.S. troops in Seoul, South Korea. He told them that he hopes the stability of the Korean Peninsula will eventually be built upon the reconciliation of North and South, but that for now it's based on the military might of the United States and South Korea.
We will not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten us or our friends or allies with weapons of mass destruction.
The president said he's made it clear to North Korea that the United States wants to improve relations, but that it's ready to defend the South if necessary. The next leg of President Bush's Asian visit is a 2-day stop in China. This will be the second time President Bush has visited China. He met with China's President Jiang Zemin during a visit in October. U.S.-Sino relations have run hot and cold in recent months. But as NPR's Don Gagne reports, the Bush administration denies relations with the communist nation are strained.
The White House would argue the opposite. I spoke with a senior administration official yesterday about some of these incidents, about the spy plane incident last spring, about the incident in which the Chinese president's plane, the Chinese equivalent of Air Force One, was discovered to have been bugged. The White House says those kinds of incidents in years past might have really caused U.S.-Chinese relations to go into the ditch. But the fact that the president is making his second trip now here to China in just a few months, they say is evidence that despite some disagreements, despite some bumpy patches that they have hit over the last year or so, that the fact that this meeting is taking place is a sign that both leaders really do feel it is important to try to figure out a way to have improved relations.
NPR's Don Gagne. Skeleton sled racer Jim Shea of the United States won a gold medal today. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
Jim Shea's first run was early in the day before snow slowed the track for other competitors, but he held on to first place in his second run, winning the first gold medal awarded in skeleton in 54 years. His father, Jim Sr., watched from the start, his mother from the finish. Jim Sr. competed in the 1964 Winter Games in cross-country skiing. Shea carried his grandfather's picture in his helmet. Jack Shea won 2 gold medals in speed skating in the 1932 Games in Lake Placid. That makes Jim Shea the nation's only third-generation Olympian. When Shea's grandfather died last month in a car accident, Shea became the sentimental favorite, and when he won the gold medal today, he was mobbed by his competitors. He embraced his mother at the finish. Back at the start, his father broke down in tears. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Utah Olympic Park.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 196 points to close at 99.41. The Nasdaq gained 25. This is NPR News. Testimony continued today in the trial of 2 San Francisco lawyers who were accused of keeping vicious dogs that mauled a neighbor to death. A woman who took care of the dogs said she told Marjorie Knoller and Robert Knoll that one of the big Presa Canarios was unpredictable and should have been shot. Knoller said they had the dogs in the hallway of her apartment house when they attacked and killed a neighbor, 33-year-old Diane Whipple. A defense attorney said yesterday that Knoller and Knoll didn't know the dogs were dangerous. The prosecutor told jurors that the dogs had attacked or lunged at people at least 30 times in the past. Egypt's prime minister says that a train fire that killed more than 370 people was caused by passengers trying to cook while on board. The BBC's Paul Wood reports from Cairo.
Speaking from his hospital bed, one man said the driver didn't realize at first that a fire had started. Passengers had to jump from the burning train while it was moving, as the wind rushed in to fan the flames. Bodies were discovered for miles along the tracks, among the dead, many children. Even after people had fought their way through the choking smoke in the dark, they found the train's windows had bars on them. One passenger called his carriage a tunnel of death. Investigations are continuing, but officials say the fire was caused by people cooking on the train. A gas canister may have exploded.
Paul Wood of the BBC. American speed skater Jennifer Rodriguez won a bronze medal in the 1500-meter race today. The gold went to Anni Freisinger and silver went to Sabine Volker, both of Germany. It was the second medal for Jennifer Rodriguez, who also won bronze in the 1000-meter race. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novozoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jonathan Kaplan describes himself as a medical vagabond. He has worked in war zones in northern Iraq, Namibia, and Burma. He's treated the sick in South African townships, served as a ship's doctor, and as a hospital surgeon in England. Now he's studying occupational medicine and stress-related illness. Dr. Kaplan has written a new memoir called The Dressing Station, A Surgeon's Chronicle of War and Medicine. Kaplan grew up in South Africa, where his parents both practiced medicine. His father spent 5 years in the South African military, treating casualties in field hospitals. The apartheid system was in place when Kaplan was studying medicine at Cape Town University. A student anti-apartheid demonstration presented him with his first casualties and his first cause.
When we heard that there was a demonstration in the middle of Cape Town City that had ended up in a confrontation between the police and students, people were asked to go and make their presence felt so that hopefully the police wouldn't arrest everybody. I went down with a small group of other students, and we arrived there to find the confrontation lines drawn up on the steps of the cathedral in Cape Town. Shortly after the police charged, it became clear that they were not prepared to tolerate any form of protest, and they used quite a lot of violence in trying to disperse the students. Quite a lot of people were arrested, were beaten. Some of us were forced back inside the cathedral itself, and then the doors were locked from the outside, preventing us escaping. It was while standing shocked and completely feeling completely helpless inside this huge, gloomy space with people sobbing on the floor and crying from tear gas and bleeding from wounds, that a friend of mine, somebody whom I didn't actually know very well at the time, started helping the injured and asked me to assist. And I suppose that was the first time that I realized that I could do something useful. I discovered that a little bit of will, a little bit of ability could make a big difference amongst people who were confused and despairing and who didn't seem to have any idea of what to do themselves. I must say, had it not been for my colleague, I wouldn't have known what to do.
What did you have to do?
I had to hold bits of rolled up cloth against gashes in heads and stop them bleeding. It wasn't very complicated, but it made a difference. It gave an appearance of order, of that something was being done. It helped to motivate people. It helped people to get over the shock and dislocation of being baton charged and beaten and discovering their own vulnerability. And it had very much the same effect for me.
Over the years, you've performed complicated surgeries, often in very makeshift situations, in third world countries, in war zones. The first patient that you operated on in a hospital near the edge of Cape Town was a situation where you thought you might faint. What caused you to feel like you might faint?
Every time I've ever been in the situation of dealing with people who are very severely injured, I've felt queasy no matter how many operations I've done, no matter how much blood I've seen flow. I opened the belly of a young man that had two bullet holes in him. It was the first time I'd ever opened somebody's abdomen. I had no idea or assurance that I'd be able to deal with what I saw in there. I was absolutely terrified. And when I looked into this incomprehensible mess of torn tissue and blood, I really did feel that I might faint. The people who were there, the operating theatre sister, the anaesthetist, looked at me and said, well, you better carry on. If you don't do something, this guy's going to die. And I discovered that in a situation like that, one does the best one can. And it has to suffice because there's nobody else sometimes present to take over, to defer to, who will take control. And that was a very important realization for me. A short while later, the registrar, the surgical registrar who was my superior, turned up and took over the operation. But I had, in the meantime, been able to stop the bleeding and been able to prevent this young man dying. And that was an experience that was probably one of the most significant of my life.
Now, this was in South Africa, which is where you're from. You had thought of staying in South Africa, but to stay, you would have been drafted into the army. You left South Africa 6 days before you were supposed to report to the military. What year was this, and what would having served in the military have meant then?
It was in 1979. I would have gone into the army for 2 years, during which I might have been a doctor, but I would have been wearing the uniform. I would have then been eligible for call-up for duty for 3 months a year for the following 12 years. I would, I'm sure, have found that under some circumstances I would have been expected or ordered to do things that I wouldn't have approved of.
Like what?
Well, it's impossible to tell, but the experience that made me decide not to go into the army was that of my friend and colleague who was a year ahead of me at medical school and who had gone to the army there for a year in advance of me. He was posted to the northern border of Namibia, which was then Southwest Africa, where the South African army was fighting a fairly aggressive war into Angola. He was posted to a forward position on the border. A prisoner was brought in who was wounded, and he was asked to stabilize the man, who was then taken off for interrogation. At some point, he was called by the special police unit who were interrogating this man and instructed to revive the prisoner who had passed out because they hadn't got all the information from him that they required. My friend noticed that the man had been tortured, and he realized that he might well die. When he objected, the officer in charge of the special police unit said, we don't care, we don't take prisoners. And he made a decision to inject the patient with something that would stop his heart.
So the doctor ended up intentionally killing the patient rather than reviving him, only to have him subjected to torture. Did the doctor think that eventually this patient was going to be tortured to death anyways, and he wanted to spare him that?
That was made explicit by the people carrying out the torture.
Whether they would end up killing him?
Yeah, they said they didn't take prisoners.
So this is what you wanted to avoid, being used as a doctor to help in torture?
I wanted to avoid being put in situations of such moral extremity. I did not want to be faced as a person, as a human being, with situations like that.
It's interesting. You've performed surgery in several war zones, and yet you refused to serve in the military of South Africa. Obviously, it wasn't because of fear, because you've been in pretty terrifying situations voluntarily. You left South Africa, went to England, and worked there in the emergency room of a hospital. One of the really significant cases there for you is the case of an elderly diabetic woman who had been mistreated for constipation. What condition was she in when you saw her?
I would point out that I'd been by then in England for some years, moving up the surgical career ladder, and was quite an experienced surgeon with a certain amount of responsibility. I only spent a year in the emergency room. This was 4 years later when I was working in under different circumstances as the surgeon in charge at a hospital over a weekend. This patient came in. She was extremely unwell. She evidently had peritonitis, an infection inside the abdominal cavity from the leakage of bowel contents. Being a diabetic, her response to infection was poor because that's part of the spectrum of the effects of diabetes. And I carried out a very quick, simple operation to stop the infection spreading, to clean out her abdomen and to prevent there being further leakage into the abdominal cavity. She then was taken to the intensive care unit, where she was hooked up to monitors and intravenous drips and catheters and ventilators, and the hope was that she might survive. Unfortunately, she developed a complication which is dreaded by all doctors, which is a condition called disseminated intravascular coagulopathy, a situation where the clotting factors in the blood become used up and the patient starts to bleed from every surface, every raw surface, from drip sites, from the gastrointestinal tract, from the gums. And the option that I was presented with was either having her bleed to death or carrying out what was in effect heroic surgery. She was bleeding from a large ulcer in her stomach, and what the only option that I had was to remove part of her stomach. I carried out that operation. Unfortunately, it was, and had I had the experience, I would probably have known this in advance, it was impossible to operate in a situation where every surface bled as soon as one touched it. And she died shortly after leaving the operating table. That was a very distressing experience, because it was the first time that I clearly saw that a decision that I had made had resulted in my actions causing the death of a patient.
But it sounds like she would have died had you not performed the surgery too.
Perhaps she would have, but that isn't the argument that prevails among surgeons.
So what impact did it have on you to lose a patient like that?
It made me reconsider the decisions I'd made, the circumstances that had brought me through my surgical training to the stage of moving up the career system. It seemed suddenly that every decision I'd ever made in the past had just been the result of luck, that it had turned out correctly, and that probably I shouldn't be subjecting humanity to my incompetent skills. At the same time, I did realize that I'd learned an awful lot in those years, that I'd acquired skills that I couldn't really apply anywhere else, and that, if nothing else, what I had become was somebody who was familiar with death in its various forms, and that one of the roles that was expected of me by my patients, that I would somehow intercede on their behalf with death, that I'd try and hold death at bay. I don't know whether that was a reasonable idea, but at the time it seemed very significant. It seemed one of the responsibilities that I couldn't sidestep, and so in the end I decided to stay within the career of surgery.
My guest is Dr. Jonathan Kaplan, author of the new memoir, The Dressing Station. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Jonathan Kaplan. He's written a new memoir called The Dressing Station, A Surgeon's Chronicle of War and Medicine. You eventually left hospitals. You did all kinds of things afterwards, as we'll discuss. What were your problems then with being in the hospital? Was your personal fear that you'd lose more patients, or did you have a problem with the system itself?
I think that I'd reached a position where there was a likely road ahead of me, and that was that I'd become an attending surgeon with a hospital post, a secure hospital post. That was what I'd been working towards all that time, and I had never doubted that that was where I'd end up. At the same time, I realized that as soon as I took that step, I'd effectively be doing that for the rest of my life, that this point that I was at was probably the last opportunity in my life when I'd have some flexibility. I'd be able to take a short detour, as I saw it then, from the career path. I did so, and I went off to work in Africa. The experiences that I had there introduced me to a whole lot of ideas, or reintroduced me to a whole lot of ideas that I'd had about medicine, that I'd had about the reason for being a doctor.
Like what?
And I suppose ideas of being useful, of serving, of being adaptable, or something that I must have gleaned from the conversations with my father and our family medical friends who had served in the Second World War, that there was some concept of service, that there was something out in the world, a huge reservoir of suffering that we all should be doing something to alleviate.
Where did you work when you returned to Africa?
At first, I worked in Namibia, now independent, the South Africans having left. And I worked as a medical officer on a government survey that was entering areas of the northern Namibian border that had been sealed off by the South African army for 15 years. They were conducting a survey of an area that had once been a demarcated game reserve to see whether there were any animals left, and whether the indigenous people who'd lived there, the known as the Bushmen, the Basarwa, still survived. I then went and worked in Zululand, where I was reminded very, very abruptly about the wildness of African medicine, because the pathology that would come in through the doors of that hospital was strange and wondrous, and unlike things that one sees in the West, except in perhaps the most extreme emergency room circumstances, perhaps in the wildest and most depressed inner city areas. But the stuff that came into that Zululand emergency room and into that hospital was such a parade of suffering and strangeness that I have never seen the like.
As you write in your book, the problems that you were typically seeing then in Africa are problems that were either eradicated or unknown in other parts of the world. And I guess one example of what you're talking about is the kind of parasites that you saw. Would you describe that?
The thing that is most striking when one starts working in Africa, encountering African medicine, is the range of intestinal parasites that affect just about everybody in the continent, especially the poor. The Ascaris worm is a particularly nasty example that always made me nauseated. It can grow up to a foot long, and it forms dense knots inside the intestinal tract that can cause obstruction. It is so well suited to living inside the human body that small changes in temperature, such as a fever caused from some other source, makes it prefer to relocate, and it'll crawl out of a nostril or a mouth or other places, and the appearance of a worm from somebody's nose is one of the things that I find most disturbing.
How do you treat it?
It can be treated by doses of something like piperazine, which is a compound that kills worms. If there are knots of worms forming obstruction, it's necessary to open the abdomen sometimes and remove those worms, in other words, by surgery.
When you were working in Zululand, you also saw a lot of medicine men, Sangoma. Did you work with them?
The relationship was a strange and tangential one. We got their patients, they got our patients. We sometimes were consulted by them, although the way that they'd come was that they'd turn up in the outpatient department with a list of complaints, asking for medication for each of those complaints. We'd supply the tablets, they'd write down what the tablets were for, and then go off presumably to grind up those tablets and incorporate them in compounds that they would feed to their patients who consulted them for similar symptoms, which seemed perfectly reasonable, and we felt that if we could establish a level of trust with them, perhaps they'd send us patients that they felt they couldn't deal with.
And did they do that?
Well, it was never that clear. People did turn up who'd previously seen the Sangomas. In some cases, they turned up because of the consequences of the medication, of the treatment that the Sangomas had given them. These might be quite mild, like making small cuts in the area of a painful part of the body, and then herbs would be rubbed into those. They might become infected, causing the person to turn up in the hospital. Or they also used to use enemas of a bush called Senecia, which has a very damaging effect on the liver and could cause irreversible liver failure, in which case we'd get children, usually, who'd been given Senecia enemas, and we'd look after them, trying hopefully to improve their liver function, but often that wasn't possible.
What kind of regard did you have for the medicine men? Did you have faith in them? Did you think that they were, that any of them were charlatans, or did you feel that they were really doing their best, even though they were using techniques that were different than the ones you would use?
That's a very difficult question to answer. While there is an enormous importance socially and in the maintenance of cultural cohesiveness in societies played by traditional healers who are often spirit intermediaries between the ancestors and the people, the problem of their concept of disease, of pathology, when it came to physical illness, was quite different from ours. Often they'd be very effective in dealing with depression and psychological and psychiatric problems in their own way. But it was difficult because of the uncertainty of the symptoms that we were treating and the symptoms that they were treating. Subsequently, there's been a much greater tendency in South Africa towards working together with traditional healers, and I'm sure that a lot of information has been exchanged that has been most beneficial to both parties.
Dr. Jonathan Kaplan's new memoir is called The Dressing Station, A Surgeon's Chronicle of War and Medicine. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback Founding Brothers, The Revolutionary Generation by Joseph J. Ellis. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Michael Kinsley tells us what he's learned about web publishing. This month, he announced that he's stepping down as editor of the online magazine Slate. In December, he disclosed that he had Parkinson's disease. And we continue our conversation with surgeon Jonathan Kaplan. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Jonathan Kaplan. In his new memoir, The Dressing Station, A Surgeon's Chronicle of War and Medicine, he writes about practicing medicine in war zones, in South African townships, and in a British hospital. Kaplan grew up in South Africa, where he studied medicine. You write in your book that you felt more useful working in Africa than you did working in regular hospitals, but that you were aware of an obscure guilt about practicing this kind of medicine. What were you guilty about?
What I discovered, the thing that I discovered working in Africa, and particularly working in this underfunded hospital that was on the edge of a continent of horrific diseases and that collected a huge amount of severe trauma of people injured in political struggles, of people injured by criminal acts, of people injured as a result of hard labor in the sugarcane fields, was that a small amount of medicine makes a big difference when one's working with people who are very deprived. But the feeling of fulfillment that I was getting from it, even in a way an increased feeling of my own humanity, came at a price, because these people generally were suffering the consequences of deprivation, of cruelty, of suffering forced upon them by the actions of others, of other human beings. And it seemed to me a source of guilt that I should be finding my fulfillment through human suffering enforced by other people. There's something distressing about feeling that one has chosen to work in the proximity of suffering, and even perhaps in the proximity of evil in some cases, in order to justify one's professional and personal existence.
On the other hand, you went to places like this because you didn't want to turn your back to suffering. You wanted to be of service.
That's correct.
So you left Africa eventually, but you left Africa and then went to Kurdistan with a human rights medical group that works in international situations and war zones. Why, after leaving Africa, did you go to a war zone?
Because human motivation is never clear-cut, and I had achieved and discovered something, some opportunity for self-realization, some form of fulfillment in Africa that I no longer felt when I got back into a conventional hospital post. When I was asked whether I'd be prepared to work in northern Iraq during the Kurdish uprising at the end of the Gulf War, I volunteered because I was trying to find out more about that situation and about the circumstances, the insight that I'd gained in these extreme situations.
Would you describe the refugee camp that you worked in there?
When I arrived in northern Iraq, the Kurdish uprising was collapsing. The Kurdish Peshmerga fighters were retreating. Millions, that is 2 million Kurdish civilians, were on their way fleeing towards the borders of the country, to northwards to Turkey and eastwards to Iran. I arrived on the Turkish-Iraqi border as huge numbers of refugees began to cross the mountains over the snowfields and try to enter Turkey. They were prevented from crossing by the Turkish military, who had been fighting their own undeclared war against their own Kurdish population for 10 years, quite a ruthless war, and had absolutely no wish to allow Iraqi Kurds to come onto to Turkish soil. So the people were trapped up on the borderline in gullies and rocks on the mountainsides, where they died of exposure and dysentery and altitude sickness, and where I arrived initially with no equipment, no personnel. I was traveling on my own. I'd been separated from the rest of my party. And I walked through this refugee camp, seeing suffering that I could do nothing to alleviate, seeing people die that I couldn't save, seeing a migration of people the like of which I'd never encountered before. And it was an experience of utter helplessness. It was very, very distressing.
You had no tools to help. You had no medical equipment with you.
None whatsoever.
Were there things that you could do to improvise?
With 400,000 people.
Right. yeah, right. You write that in Kurdistan you became aware of the perverse seduction of war. What is that seduction?
There is a clarity to life, to understanding things, that comes in a place where everything depends on one's decision-making and one's survival and that of one's patience depends on the way in which you see problems and you see solutions. There is none of the insidious dread that goes with dealing with daily issues like mortgages and pensions and careers and property. Life is the way life looks, and there is a freedom associated with that that, of course, is also partly coloured by the possibility of immediate and rather violent death or disfigurement. It's not a very healthy situation, and it's not a very pure pleasure, because fear is very unpleasant and it's often very frightening. But there is some quality of insight that I've had in places like that that I've never found anywhere else in my life.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your work. Thank you.
My pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Jonathan Kaplan's new memoir is called The Dressing Station, A Surgeon's Chronicle of War and Medicine. He's now studying occupational medicine and stress-related illness. Coming up, Michael Kinsley reflects on his 6 years editing the web magazine Slate. This is Fresh Air. When Michael Kinsley left his position as editor of The New Republic in 1996 to become the founding editor of the web magazine Slate, many of his colleagues thought he was crazy. It seemed like an untested idea. Slate has since become one of the most respected online publications, offering commentary on politics and culture. The magazine is published by Microsoft. Last week, Kinsley stepped down as editor. In December, he disclosed that he has Parkinson's disease. Kinsley is also a former editor of Harper's and a former liberal commentator on CNN's Crossfire. We invited him to share some of the things he's learned about web publishing. I asked him about the biggest drawbacks he experienced putting out an online magazine.
People do not like reading on a computer screen. One of our minor embarrassments was when Bill Gates was quoted in the newspapers as saying he prefers to read magazines in print. And I think most people feel that way. And the other thing, which is related, is we have not found a way, although we've experimented with various techniques, to publish the kind of long magazine essay or repertorial piece that runs in the New Yorker or the Atlantic or the New York Times Sunday Magazine. That's the one thing you really cannot do, or at least we haven't found a way to do, on the web.
Did you try?
We've tried in various ways. When we started, we just ran these long pieces. And we decided, well, we not only decided, but we knew that very few people were reading them. Because, of course, you can tell on the web exactly how many people have read not only each issue, to the extent you have a concept called an issue, but each individual page. And people just weren't reading them. We had an interesting experiment, which we're still playing around with, where the writer, instead of accumulating all the reporting and then sitting down and writing a long piece, sort of reports in on his reporting or her reporting as they go along. So the one we did was our writer David Plotz, who's our Washington bureau chief, got very interested in the so-called Nobel Prize sperm bank, which was a thing in the 70s where someone collected sperm allegedly from Nobel Prize winners, although that didn't really happen, and to sort of create a eugenicist paradise. And the thing sort of collapsed in bankruptcy, but there were kids born from this experiment, and no one had ever followed up what had happened to them. And David sort of kept a journal of his reporting. He wrote an opening piece saying this is what he intended, invited people to get in touch with him, and there was a very useful feedback loop that was created where people would read this and know someone who knew one of these kids or one of the parents, and they would report back, and it became a sort of mystery story. You could follow his detective work trying to track down the story and expose the skeleton of the reporting of a piece like this. And the net result was, I'm sure, about the length or longer than one of these New Yorker or New York Times Magazine type pieces, but it was over the course of days and weeks, and it was in little bits, and it was much more readable on the web. And that was one model that I think is promising.
I want to take you back to 1996 when you first joined Microsoft to create Slate Magazine on the web. This was one of the early web magazines. You were probably given a lot of advice at the time. Think back to us to 1996. What kind of advice were you given then at a time when many people didn't even know about the web and weren't reading things on the web?
Well, in 1996, the web was still controlled, or at least heavily influenced by sort of techies and techie philosophers rather than businesses and media. And it wasn't establishment yet as it has become. And that was a very wild and free period, and many people were offended when Microsoft got involved and I got involved as they regarded an establishment journalist. And there was a saying that information wants to be free, meaning that the very idea of commercializing the web was offensive and innately wrong. And I think that has turned out to be a fallacy, that the web is a medium like any other, and it can be corrupt like any other. It can also be a wonderful medium for expression like any other, and it can be a wonderful medium for commerce like any other. So they were wrong about that. They were right about something I was wrong about, which is that I came in thinking that we would charge money to customers for Slate, and that was the model that would lead to profitability. And we tried charging for a year, and it didn't work, really. We had 30,000 paying subscribers, which wasn't terrible, but we had 400,000 people monthly visiting our free part, our front porch, as we called it. And now we have 3 or 4 million. We aren't making money yet, but it looks as if trying to sell advertising to many millions of people is a more logical way to break even than trying to get 1995 from a few dozen thousand.
When you started editing Slate, did techies give you any advice about how the location on the internet should affect the format in the magazine, how being a web magazine should affect the content?
Well, one of the really exciting things about the past few years was that we were not only inventing a publication, but we were helping at least to invent a medium. We had long debates and discussions about should there be paging or should there be scrolling, how you get from one article to another, how you get from a table of contents. Do you have a table of contents? What should be on your home page? And all sorts of things like that. The way I came to think about it was we were essentially having to invent paper and invent ink in order to put out our magazine. And many of these conventions in print date back centuries. And some of the conventions are already fairly well established now, 5 or 6 years later, on the internet. And as the next few years go on, the web will ultimately reach the point where people will not have to think through navigation and issues like that. But it will be much easier, but a certain amount of the excitement will be gone.
Have you found that the writing that you edit is any different on the web than the writing was in hard copy print magazines that you did? Are you looking for something different stylistically?
Yes and no. We at Slate regarded it as very important, because people are so skeptical about the internet, to have the same standards of careful editing and accuracy on the web as there was in print and is in print. We have basically two kinds of articles, if you can call them articles, features, forms of journalism in our magazine. One is basically traditional magazine articles. They tend to be a bit shorter. The other one, though, is something which can only be done on the web, which is basically the voice of email. Email is a really wonderful medium for the exchange of ideas. When it works well, it's got the spontaneity of talking and the reflectiveness of writing. So when I came to Slate, I tried to develop features which captured that excitement and integrity combination. And we have dialogues on issues. We have a feature called The Breakfast Table, where two interesting people simply talk about what's in the day's news, emailing each other back and forth. And I think very often it really does work, and it's the kind of thing that is tightly connected to the technology of the internet.
Well, one of the things that you can do on the web that you just can't do in hard copy magazines is you can count the number of people who visited the site, then you can count the number of the people who visited each individual article. This is interesting but potentially heartbreaking information to have. If you're a writer publishing in a popular online magazine, but you find out that very few people are actually visiting your article, that could be very sad indeed. And then you, Michael Kinsley, as the editor, would have to decide, well, does that mean this writer is out, this feature is out? Can you talk a little bit about how you used that empirical system to make editorial decisions?
Well, you're right, Terry. It really is the apple of knowledge that can lead to all sorts of unfortunate consequences. We actually at Slate don't use it too much. I don't think I've ever killed a feature because of the traffic measurements. But you can't help but be influenced by it. You have to keep in mind, though, that traffic figures can be very misleading. An article that is not very good can get a huge amount of traffic if we feature it in our headline space on our homepage, or if MSN, the Microsoft network, which we're a part of, features it on the network homepage. That can affect its total traffic much more than its innate merits. So for that reason, and because I think a magazine should have its own voice and not be a popularity contest, we don't pay too much attention to these traffic figures. We pay attention to the total traffic figures, and we certainly brag about them to advertisers, but the traffic to individual articles, we don't pay a lot of attention to.
Have the writers had an approach avoidance relationship with those numbers, you know, really wanting to know how many people read my piece but scared to find out?
We don't offer them that information.
How come?
For basically the reason you suggest. If it turns out they're very popular, they may want more money. We don't want them to find that out.
Yeah.
And if they're very unpopular, they may get depressed, and a depressed writer is even worse than an undepressed writer to deal with.
My guest is Michael Kinsley. He's the founding editor of the web magazine Slate. He stepped down as editor last week. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Kinsley is my guest, and he's the founding editor of Slate Magazine. He started with Slate in 1996. This is an online publication. And he recently announced that he's going to be leaving as editor of Slate, although he will continue to write for the publication. Slate is owned by Microsoft. What was it like for you during the Microsoft trial? Did you cover it? And what are the difficulties of covering a trial of your owner?
We covered the Microsoft trial, I think, in a way that proved our independence. We had a novelistic typewriter covering it, and she's a lawyer who certainly understood and explained the issues, but described the characters like in a novel. And she was not terribly flattering to the Microsoft characters, the lawyers for the company and the witnesses for the company.
Did you go into Bill Gates and say, well, this is going to be pretty critical of you, but it will help our credibility to do that, so, you know.
I have never had that conversation with Bill Gates, but I think he senses it. Being owned by Microsoft in terms of editorial independence has been a perfect experience. And I've never worked for a publication where I've had less interference. In fact, there couldn't be less because there's been none. I find it, this gets my goat a little bit, this subject. People are so suspicious of Microsoft. The average publication owned by a media conglomerate, Time Warner even before it was part of AOL, or News Corp, the Murdoch Empire, has far more conflicts of interest in the course of its daily and weekly publishing schedule than we do. I mean, the subject of software and the subject of Microsoft Corporation don't come up that often naturally in a magazine or website devoted to politics and culture. It comes up some, but not that often. Whereas every time a Time Warner publication reviews a movie, reviews a book, it bumps up against some of the other media properties owned by that same company. But media companies don't get this sort of suspicion. Now, in part, that's because they build up reputations over the years for editorial independence, and Microsoft was unproven. But at this point, I think it has proven its understanding that, as you say, Terry, editorial independence is a smart commercial decision if you're going to publish content, as it's sort of vulgarly called on the Internet, media, news, whatever. You have to have credibility, and credibility requires independence. And Microsoft has really been perfect about that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Kinsley, and he's the founding editor of Slate, which is an online politics and culture magazine. He announced this month that he's going to be leaving his position as editor, although he'll continue to write for Slate. In December, Kinsley announced that he had Parkinson's disease and that he'd actually been diagnosed several years ago. Michael, how come you decided to come out about Parkinson's in December?
Well, I kept it a secret simply because it was easier to get through the day not thinking about it if the people you dealt with in the course of the day didn't know about it. And after 8 years, which is a longer run than I expected to have, enough people knew about it because the few people I had told other people. And the symptoms were evident enough that it was more trouble to keep it a secret than not to. And when the balance of inconvenience shifted, I decided to go public. It was a completely selfish balance of advantage to me decision.
How bad are your symptoms now?
I don't think they're very bad. This gravelly sound you hear in my voice is probably a symptom. That's really the most noticeable thing, I think. When I went public with this, most people were surprised or shocked. Some people suspected that there was something wrong, and some people knew there was something wrong. But the fact that the majority of even people I saw all the time didn't know I had it indicates to me that the symptoms are not all that serious.
What are some of the things you want to do with the time that you're freeing up by virtue of leaving your position as editor of Slate?
The one thing I really want to do, in case I can't do it later, is adventurous outdoor type stuff, which I had no interest in doing whatsoever before I got Parkinson's and before I moved out to the Pacific Northwest. But, you know, if you told me 10 years ago, gee, you might not be able to go camping and hiking for the rest of your life, I'd say, who cares? I haven't gone camping and hiking for the first part of my life. But then when they suddenly tell you you might not be able to do it, you really want to do it. And I moved out to the Pacific Northwest where these kinds of outdoor activities are central to life, and I've fallen in love with it. And I hope to squeeze a bit more of that in than I otherwise would be able to with a job like editor of Slate.
Well, Michael Kinsley, I wish you the best, and I thank you very
thank
much
you,
for talking
Terry.
With us.
You too.
Michael Kinsley was the founding editor of the web magazine Slate. He stepped down from his position last week, but will continue to write for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Mary and O'Neill, a novel and stories by Justin Cronin, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Martin Short talks about his TV show Primetime Glick, a satire of celebrity interview programs. He plays the self-absorbed interviewer, Jiminy Glick. A new season of Primetime Glick premieres this weekend on Comedy Central. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.